how do you help yourself to not say yes right away?
So one of the things I do like to do, you know, if it's something like a mentorship or someone's asking for information, I take an engineering approach. I'm like, how can I solve this in a way that scales? And so is it a blog post that I can write, or a video I can record, or a podcast just like this that I can record and share with them as a way to not only answer their question, but also potentially answer it for someone that doesn't know they want to ask the question yet. And so that's really been something I've tried to focus on more and more, is how can I scale the information that, you know, from one-on-one to one-to-many.
Hello, and welcome to Developer's Journey, the podcast bringing you the making of stories of successful software developers to help you on your upcoming journey. I'm your host, Tim Bourguignon. On this episode, I receive Brian Childress. Brian is a husband, father, technologist, and avid adventurer. As a technological advisor with a strong background in software engineering, cloud computing, and cybersecurity, he is experienced in helping CTOs and CEOs make the right technical decisions for their organizations. And the rest, we're going to hear today. Brian, a warm welcome to DevJourney.
Tim, thanks for having me. It's great to be here, bud.
My pleasure. But before we come to your story, I want to thank the terrific listeners who support the show every month. You are keeping the Dev Journey lights up. If you would like to join this fine crew and help me spend more time on finding phenomenal guests than editing audio tracks, please go to our website, devjourney.info, and click on the Support Me on Patreon button. Even the smallest contributions are giant steps toward a sustainable Dev Journey. Thank you. And now back to today's guest. Brian, as you know, the show exists to help listeners understand what your story looked like and imagine how to shape their own future. So as is usual on the show, let's go back to your beginnings. Where would you place the start of your Dev Journey?
Let's see. I remember taking some very rudimentary programming classes in high school. But really, I think for me, my programming journey started in graduate school, honestly. I was not the kid programming on my family's computer at 8 years old. It wasn't me. So I really didn't get into computers until I went back to graduate school. And from there, really, really found my passion and have continued to grow and evolve in software engineering since then.
Mm-hmm. For the non-US listeners, grad school is the equivalent of college. Is it something like this?
So post my bachelor's degree. So this is working more towards like a master's or something along those lines. Yep.
Okay. How did you come to discovering or rediscovering computer programming at that point in time?
So my undergraduate degree, my bachelor's degree, was in something kind of so far removed from software engineering and computer science, it kind of wasn't even funny. I actually started my professional career as an outdoor guide. So I would take people whitewater rafting and mountain biking and rock climbing and that sort of thing, and really, really enjoyed that work, but found, a little bit of time into that I wasn't completely fulfilled. It wasn't really kind of, as intellectually challenging. Didn't really kind of do the things that I was looking for it to do. And so at that point, I went back to graduate school. I went back to college to learn geographic information systems. I felt like that was a good kind of blend between the things that I found interesting and my passion for outdoors and outdoor adventure. And that's what got me into programming. At that point, we were learning Python was the primary language that we use in GIS, and was, building some small data analysis programs and working in various systems. And, that was kind of, I would say, the beginning of what's led me to where I am today.
Mm-hmm. So very much as a tool first for doing something else, for doing GIS analysis or whatever you do in GIS, I have no idea. And then it evolved into a subject matter in itself.
Absolutely. Yep. That's exactly right.
Do you remember when this U-turn happened?
Well, I was a ski bum. So I was living in a small town in Colorado. I was a painter during the day, and that allowed me to live and ski and do those sorts of things. And, you know, that I had a great time, right? I was in my early 20s. And, you know, from there, went and did some outdoor guiding. I had already been doing it, you know, kind of all throughout college, but found, you know, I want something different, right? I want a different challenge. And it was at that point that I decided, hey, let me look at going back to school for something to continue to, you know, grow and expand my skills and maybe find something that I'm even more passionate about. And that's where I kind of stumbled into GIS as I had no idea what it was when I even started looking into it. It just kind of brought together a few different interests of mine. And then from there, I just continued to evolve. And after graduate school, got out into the workforce developing software.
Okay. So you didn't work as a GIS expert? What would you do as a GIS graduate?
I did for about 4 months.
Okay.
I worked as a contractor for the transportation department. And so basically for GIS, it's you know, putting information and tying it to points on the globe, right? So it's the same technology that makes our GPS units work and, you know, Strava and all of those types of apps. It's all based on GIS technology. And so, you know, working for the transportation department, it was not nearly as glamorous, right? I was basically putting together and analyzing large amounts of data that had been collected on our highway systems and bridges and, you know, culverts that run underneath roads and signs that are on the side of the roads and that sort of thing. And so, you know, it was good, you know, to kind of get out there and practice a lot of the things that I had been learning in school, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't exciting. It wasn't the thing that I was really looking for. And in a prior job that I had, you know, I worked three jobs to put myself through graduate school. And one of those jobs, I had worked with a company who was doing, they were contractors for Medicare and Medicaid. And they had an opportunity to come on as an application developer with their group. So they had an internal software platform that they had built, and they offered to bring me on. And I jumped at the opportunity. I thought it would be a great way to kind of learn. And, you know, I think I kind of missed being a junior developer and kind of going through those, you know, climbing the ranks. I kind of skipped right over some of those steps and was thrown right into the deep end. And, you know, I think I've continued to go forward from there.
Is that your way of learning or of going at problems with air quotes, jumping in the cold water, going to the deep end and seeing what happens?
I think it is. Maybe not intentionally. That seems to be the way it happens. But yeah, I kind of just go for it and figure some things out along the way and, you know, get some skin to knees and that sort of thing. But yeah, I would say it's probably been a theme throughout my career is to kind of take that approach.
All right. Fair enough. How did you go being, I assume, and correct me if I'm wrong, kind of a sole developer during your studies, working on your data analysis and tools, but probably, at least it was for me, without all the best practices of software engineering, really doing coding, I would say, but not crafting software for the long term with the legacy in mind, etc., and jumping into this new world of application development and discovering all this, I assume. Or did you discover that beforehand? How did that transition work?
I very much learned that on the job, and a lot of that was just what I thought was right, because I didn't necessarily always have a team that I could rely on. I didn't have like great software mentors that I could lean on that had years of experience and could, you know, tell me about all the ways that this could go wrong. I kind of just followed my gut and, you know, thankfully made some decent decisions most of the time. But yeah, I didn't have a lot of that mentorship early on. And so I sought it out in other ways. I tried, and I think early in my career is when I started to not only I was working full time as an application developer, but I started freelancing and moonlighting and doing development projects on my own. And I think I attribute a lot of my success to that hard work of doing freelancing and moonlighting to learn a lot of those things. And it was just another way that I could kind of make those mistakes and then hopefully learn from them.
That's the deep end of the pool again.
Yeah. Exactly right.
Going from freelance projects as the, you said, not junior, but still beginner in your career. That's ballsy, I would say. Wow. So how did you find those projects? How did you manage to get in there with probably not so much experience to show for?
I don't know, charm and charisma. I mean, some of the early projects, I was finding on, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but like Craigslist.com. This is many years ago. I was creating websites for wedding venues and insurance companies and that sort of thing. And it wasn't necessarily software engineering, right? I was kind of largely putting together WordPress websites, but I had met some people at meetups, a really good friend, he and I still collaborate today, met a meetup group just randomly, just a user group, and he and I have collaborated and worked on things. And so he and I would kind of bump through that together. But I just always looked for opportunities to kind of learn, and found a lot of the things that I was learning on my own in those early days, I'm continuing to use today. So it was really, really beneficial. I probably didn't know what I didn't know at that point, and maybe that was an advantage, because I didn't let it hold me back that I didn't know those things.
Yeah. The benefit of being young and still naive and just going at it. You mentioned meetups. So you discovered meetup really early on in your career?
I did. Oh. I was ravenous because I wasn't collaborating with a lot of people in my day-to-day work, especially not from a software perspective. And so I was ravenous for more information and to be around folks that were doing it. And it was kind of at that time where startups were a really, really sexy thing. Like everybody wanted to be in startups, because we were hearing about the explosion of Google's popularity and all the free food and the slides and all of those kinds of cool things that was coming out around that time. And so there was just a lot of draw towards it. I had one of my college roommates, was a founder in a startup, and it was like three guys in a small bedroom apartment in San Francisco, like developing software that ended up growing and growing. Like, it was just a very exciting thing. And so I wanted to find a way to break into that, and meetups were a way to do that. And at the time I was living in Denver, and there's a huge startup population there. And so I was able to attend a meetup every night if I wanted to, different user groups. It was just a very popular thing. And, from that made a lot of great connections, learned a lot, and it also kind of pushed me out of my shell. I'm not naturally, kind of extroverted and so it really kind of pushed me to go and meet other people and learn from them and see what I could share and maybe help them in some way.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to be piggybacking on that. How would you behave going into a meetup, to a first meetup? You come in a city, you haven't been to that meetup yet, and the first time you show up, how would you be able to start making connections, feel at ease, just feel like somebody who's welcome there?
It wasn't easy for me. I tend to be kind of more reserved, held back. I'll be the ones kind of sitting in the back corner of the room, kind of seeing what others are doing. But I found for me, the way that I kind of broke through some of that was I would sit like in a spot like up towards the front, like a couple rows back, kind of a few seats in, basically in a spot where someone was almost forced to sit next to me. And then when we're sitting next to each other, like, because most of the meetups were, there was a presentation and then some networking, and we would have pizza and beer afterwards. And so by having somebody sit next to me, then, you know, it was just more of a one-on-one conversation that I could kind of break through that, you know, that anxiety or that fear, and we could start to talk about things. And because we were at the same user group, it was largely based around a specific technology or, you know, a topic that was really interesting. I could then use that as my opening, you know, hey, Tim, what, you know, interests you about JavaScript or something along those lines.
That's a good one. I've heard a couple others on how to break in there. One was to sit as well in the front, but mostly to attract the eyes of the person speaking. When you're a speaker, you're quite often searching for somebody who's really attentive, and then you focus on that person. It's your persona for the audience. And I found it personally calming to be that person for the speaker, and then it was easier to talk to the speaker afterwards and break the ice. And yeah, you've been looking at me for an hour now, so let's chat. And that felt easier, at least to me. And I've heard that from a couple of persons as well, that it helped them break that high and that ice.
And then that's great. I mean, I do the same thing now that I'm doing conference speaking. Mm-hmm. I do the same exact thing. I'll pick out a couple people in the room. And they're my anchors. No one else exists in the room. It's pretty wild.
Yeah, that's the secret. It really helps. And the other one I've heard is to go to someone and ask them for referral. Asking them maybe, do you know who I could talk to about React? I'm passionate about React. Maybe it's not a React meetup, but I'm passionate about React. You know someone here whom I should talk to? And it's a great way to have this person answer you and help you without cornering her or him into having to talk to you. If they don't want to talk to you, they can just say, well, talk to Bob over there. He's knowledgeable about that. And hop, there you go. And if it's their topic, then they can start talking to you. And those two combined, so sitting in the front and using this diversion technique, it really helped me personally in many conferences to come there and know no one and start talking from the get-go. That's really, really helpful.
Nice. I like that a lot. I'm going to have to borrow that.
Yes. Okay. So you are on that journey, started your first gigs, or at least your first job, doing God knows how many gigs on the side as a freelancer, and learning during meetups. Did you sleep at that time?
Not much. Thankfully, in graduate school, I was also introduced to coffee. So I've been an avid consumer since.
I hear you.
Yeah.
So how long did that lifestyle work out? Did you have to change something at some point?
I don't know. I'll let you know when it happens. I have a personality that naturally just, I want to have a lot of different things going on. And so I found it ebbs and flows a little bit. I kind of get to the brink of burnout, or maybe actually burn out, and then I have to take a little bit of a break. But a lot of things interest me. And so I try and, you know, explore a lot of different things.
Do you have to actively restrain yourself from going in one or the other direction just because you know it's going to be too much?
Now I do. I absolutely do. Earlier on, I think, in those early days, you're just looking for anything, especially around technology, like which technologies do I enjoy? Which ones do I not? What problems do I like to solve? What industries are interesting? And now I feel like I've got a better idea of those things. And so I try to restrain myself a bit more. But it's still hard to say no. If somebody comes and says, you know, hey, can you help out with this thing? Or do you mind mentoring me? It's really hard to say no.
So how do you help yourself to not say yes right away?
So one of the things I do like to do, you know, if it's something like a mentorship or someone's asking for information, I take an engineering approach. I'm like, how can I solve this in a way that scales. And so is it a blog post that I can write, or a video I can record, or a podcast just like this that I can record and share with them as a way to not only answer their question, but also potentially answer it for someone that doesn't know they want to ask the question yet. And so that's really been something I've tried to focus on more and more, is how can I scale the information that, you know, from one-on-one to one to many.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so you've been writing blog posts, publishing videos, etc., creating your own content for that, or partially for that?
Partly for that, partly for myself too. My blog has taken a bit of a hit over the past year or two, just life, it's gotten busy. But I originally started that for me. I wanted a place to be able to reference information. And so I started it there, and, you know, I found just having a blog, a public space on the internet, has been hugely beneficial. It's helped me to get jobs and bypass technical sections of interviews, and, you know, it's been really, really helpful.
Mm-hmm. And there's not quite anything like Googling for something and finding one of your old blog posts.
I wish I could tell you how many times that's happened, that I've appeared on the first page of Google, and oh yeah, I wrote about this a year ago. I've already figured this out. Yeah.
And forgotten about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is awesome. Just write about it. You immerse yourself enough into the subject matter to really be able to write about it, and then forget about it entirely and rediscover it later.
Yeah, it's just like high school, right? Yeah. We studied enough to pass the test, and then we immediately forgot everything.
Amen to
now
that.
I just have a resource.
Yeah. Amen to that. So you mentioned, I'm jumping back a bit, you mentioned you skipped junior dumb. I'm not sure that's the word, but now it is. And you jumped both feet first into a more senior role. How did that evolve afterwards? Is there some more graduation of senior? Is there different flavors of seniority? What kind of thoughts does that trigger?
I think for me, yeah, there were various areas of senior that I focused on. So it became less about creating something that worked and more focused on creating something that's maintainable, that I can collaborate with a larger team on. That continues to kind of focus on solving a business problem. So it still wasn't as like heavy technology focused. It was just more, how do we solve this problem, but do it in a more maintainable way? Because, you know, a lot of the things that I was doing earlier on, it wasn't as important. They weren't as long lived projects and that sort of thing. But as I continued to progress in my career, I found, you know, that was actually important. And so then I became the person that really, really focused on, you know, quality and craftsmanship in the software, and took a lot of pride in that. And so, you know, now working with a number of different clients, that's something that I really, really focus on, because I found it hugely valuable for me, for the teams that I worked on. And now, you know, for my clients, as they continue to grow and scale, it's something that I still like to focus on.
Mm-hmm. How do you approach, selling is not the right word, but convincing somebody, they have a software which is working, and now is the time to start focusing on more quality, more craftsmanship, more sustainability, and more effort for the long term. How do you approach this discussion with them?
So I think it's important to know our audience and who are we talking to. And so I always like to understand, what are the things that drive that particular person? If it's the business owner, they may not care about the code quality as long as it works. So I can talk about, well, what happens if it doesn't work? Or what happens when we need to expand it to onboard a new customer that's going to bring additional revenue into the business? And if we don't focus on the quality and the craftsmanship and the maintainability now, it's going to be very difficult for us to bring in that new customer, which is then either going to delay them coming on board, or potentially we could lose them as a customer altogether. And so really kind of focusing on, what is that particular person interested in, and then tying in, you know, the technology and software from there.
Yeah, that's a very, very important advice. Really knowing your audience and tailoring your arguments for that. Obviously, if you start talking with them about, I don't know, principles, solid principles, etc., it's not going to connect.
No, it usually doesn't. Yeah.
So, in the bio I read at the beginning, you kind of hinted as now you would be doing some kind of consulting job. Is this how you would describe it?
Yeah. So, you know, I've been doing the kind of the freelancing and the moonlighting for a number of years. So, I mean, call it consulting. And so now I'm full-time fractional CTO and technical advisor. So I consult with a number of different startups and small and medium businesses that are developing custom software, typically in the B2B space, and helping them to, you know, I like to say that I help get turn around struggling software projects and help them to scale. And so that's what I do.
Okay. So fractional CTO would be kind of a sidekick of a CTO learning the ropes? Or how would you describe a fractional CTO?
So the way I operate is, you know, I bring years of, you know, expertise and, you know, lessons learned and mistakes made to organizations that may not need or may not be able to afford a full-time CTO. And oftentimes they don't need a full-time CTO, right? A lot of organizations are probably just looking for a really strong lead developer, and they call them the CTO. And so what I'm doing is helping them to, you know, I bring a strong background in software architecture and scalability. So, you know, we'll focus there if that's what they're looking for. Bring in a lot of just software engineering best practices, right? Code reviews and deployment strategies and that sort of thing. Bring a lot of that in. Big focus on security as well, application security, and, you know, how can we grow the team in a way that's effective? All of those types of things I help my clients out with. So it's a bit of a mix. You know, different fractional CTOs kind of focus in different areas, but those are the areas that I tend to focus on most.
Okay. So I hear really laying down the foundation, whispering the right words, putting things in motion so that it evolves in the right direction from the get-go. And then it will evolve without you. You'll probably be somewhere else. As I imagine, your gigs are probably short term or a few months, but not much more than this. Am I right there?
Typically, yeah. I kind of aim for 3 to 6 months in most organizations. It may be longer. We just might taper off how much time I'm committing to that particular engagement. Mm-hmm. Yeah, ultimately, my goal is to work myself out of a job, right? Put those systems in place to empower the right people, potentially bring on board full time the people in the right role, and then kind of work myself out of it. You know, that's tends to be the best and the most exciting approach for me.
Mm-hmm. How do you manage to get in and right away start thinking about your exit? I would go full all in and say, okay, now I'm there. And 2 years later, I would wake up and say, oh gosh, where did time go? How do you handle this phasing in, phasing out, and right away probably searching for next gig and phasing it different gig at the same time? How do you handle all this?
So it goes kind of, can I give the classic it depends answer? right. We've got a bunch of developers. So I tend to kind of ramp up quickly. You know, we'll do potentially a discovery month where we figure out, okay, what are the real problems here that we want to solve? You know, is it scalability? Is it team collaboration? Is it, you know, we picked the wrong technologies and we need to do a big refactoring. So we'll figure out what's going on, kind of put together a strategy, put together, you know, what resources do we need? What team members do we need? And then I'll tend to oversee that process as it goes through. You know, we'll kind of adjust as needed and then ultimately taper off. And so once the project is moving along well, the right team members are in place, then I'll taper off into more like of a, you know, kind of an advisory or a retainer type of role, where I'm still available to the team, but not necessarily as hands-on day to day. But I mean, it's nice because I can kind of come in and shake things up. and really focus on what's best for the business, what's best for the project. I don't have the same type of limitations, I think, around like trying to be friends with everybody, right? I don't want to, alienate anyone, but I am coming in there to solve a problem. I am coming in there to help the organization. So with that focus, it allows me to, make some decisions that I might not make if I were coming in as a full-time person.
Yeah, makes sense. You mentioned the tagline, or at least I know it's your tagline on LinkedIn, helping struggling projects. Do you think it's because of this tagline, because of this focus that you've been giving to your career, that companies which are struggling at a point in time go out and reach out to you? Or is it all those companies try to make it on their own and at some point realize something is not working right, and at some point then reach out to find somebody with knowledge, call it a fractional CTO or any other name, and then find someone to steer the ship back into the right direction?
Yeah, I don't know that it's the tagline necessarily that draws them in, but I have, from a lot of my LinkedIn content, has drawn folks in to my world. So, I've had the pleasure of working on a number of different projects that were struggling because they, the architecture, the technologies that they had chosen were too complex. The team wasn't delivering on time. They, may have had other challenges. They might have hired a development agency or a freelancer who just kind of walked away with all the code. There's a number of different things that have kind of happened. But yeah, a lot of the content that I put out on platforms like LinkedIn kind of speaks to the challenges that I see, unfortunately, day to day. And it's organizations that, may not have a strong technical focus, and so they relinquish a lot of control over to the development team or even an outside agency or an outside freelancer, and they just lose control. And ultimately, a lot of the times when I come in, it's I've got a lot of work to do, turn things around sometimes. So.
I hear you. I'm sure I wanted to swear, but didn't know if you could. if you imagined going to a project that wouldn't be struggling right now, would you be attacking this problem? Let's call it a problem with the same way, doing this discovery months, trying to find where the problems are, or would you go at it differently if it wasn't obviously struggling from the get-go?
I think I would go at it a little bit differently. Typically, when I come into a struggling project, we've spent a lot of money. We're over budget, we're over time. The team is frustrated. They're working a lot of long hours. So we have to make some very drastic, quick decisions to kind of turn us around. But if that's not the case, I love to come into projects where I just kind of get to sit and hang out and talk with the developers one-on-one, maybe provide some mentorship to them and just see where things are. Like, what is that normal process for the team, and look for areas that I can add some efficiencies, that I can, continue to maybe push some of the developers towards opportunities of growth if that's what they're looking for. If I don't have to, I love to be able to kind of sit back and just see how things operate. And really just make sure that I focus on showing that I really appreciate all the work that has been done up until this point. Because if those developers hadn't put in all those hours and the blood, sweat, and tears to develop the platform to what it is today, I wouldn't have a job, right? They wouldn't be bringing me in. Now, I might be coming in to kind of fix and tweak things, but it's because of all their hard work that I have the opportunity to come in. And so I always want to be grateful for that and really show the developers that I'm there to help support them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, amen to that. It's always a hard balance to strike between coming in and seeing things and saying, hey, maybe we should change this. And you're going to hurt some feelings because that's the way they were successful so far. And so you're going to push it places where it usually is painful. But at the same time, listening in and really understanding from second degree observation, really understanding why are things this way, why it was done this way, and why it evolved into this situation, to just really understand how it came to being there, and not just remove something that is absolutely crucial for the organization. Sounds silly, you just remove it and the organization crumbles. So really trying to find this balance is always hard. And how does it work on a 3 to 6 months timeline when you first want to observe? Do you have enough time?
So we can observe in a lot of different areas. And so I tend to like really poke in a lot of different places, right? I'll not only schedule conversations with the kind of the key folks, I'll schedule conversations with members across the team. I'll poke around in Slack. You know, I'll look at the conversations that are happening in all the public channels and any private channels that have been added to see what that conversation is. I'll look at pull requests and the comments that are added there. How is code added and deployed? And I'll look at documentation and how are we collaborating on that? And so there's a lot of different areas that I can kind of observe without it being a one-on-one conversation with someone. And so I'll look for those areas. I'll look for trends. And from there, you know, I've been in enough organizations and on enough teams and projects that, you know, there's at least a few different solutions I might be able to propose to the team as an opportunity to improve.
Mm-hmm. I see. You've mentioned burnout or kind of burnout before. This going in, going out, going in, going out, jumping on a new project is probably linked with a lot of stress, or at least long hours to really find find north, understand what's happening, the topology of the company, etc. And then by the time you're confident with all this, well, it's time to start with a new company. Do you think you're going to have the stamina to do this for a long time? Do you see yourself doing this for years and years and years?
I think so. I've certainly evolved my approach over time. You know, I've got a much more robust playbook that I follow now that allows me to kind of get to some of that information a little bit more readily. But I think some of my next phases are actually going to be to grow the group that I work with and collaborate with closely. So potentially bringing on other architects and technical advisors and other fractional CTOs to be able to help me to scale and take some of that day-to-day work off of my plate. So I can be a bit more strategic with some of the work, but not I still want to be able to help as many organizations as I can to deliver great software at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. When you mentioned playbook, it sounds like taking up a silly project of writing a book about all this, which would end up with even longer hours.
It's conversations like these. And so anytime that I find that I, you know, make a suggestion or come up with an idea, I'll dump it into the playbook and just kind of continually add to it over time. And so it's more of a, what would I already be doing normally? Let me put that into one place instead of, a concerted effort to write a book. It's more just kind of collecting, you know, from all my notebooks and all my conversations, pulling all that together.
Is this publicly available? Is this your blog, or is this still notes for yourself?
It's a mix. So some things, you know, I'm happy to share any of it. None of it's secretive, but I don't have it in a pretty format that is probably digestible by most. Anything like there's, how do I do due diligence on a technical project? How do I do an architecture review? You know, a lot of those things I've absolutely shared with, other fractional CTOs or technical advisors in the industry. I'm happy to share any of that if it's helpful in any sense.
If we can link some to the show notes to give a taste of what we've been talking about, I think that would be great for the audience.
Absolutely. Yeah, happy to share.
Awesome. Do you see yourself doing this for years and years and years? So you said yes, kind of, but I heard helping more companies. Is this scalable, being in the trenches and doing some strategic work, etc.? Will your work change, basically?
That's what I'm trying to figure out now, if I'm honest, Tim. What does that scaling look like? Having a playbook, having a set of repeatable processes certainly helps. I think helping to scale it, I need folks to collaborate with, colleagues that have years and years of industry experience and have, been in those trenches before and have, really that level of experience and made some of those similar mistakes to be able to collaborate with. And I think that's something as an industry we're struggling a little bit with, is we don't have a ton of people at that experience level that are still practitioners in the industry. I'm always looking for opportunities to collaborate with folks in that way.
There you put the word I was trying to find and ask my question very clumsily. Being a practitioner, is what I fear for you when I hear this is that you're going to graduate into some kind of management slash strategic position and not be a practitioner anymore. And I fear it because I have the feeling that you need this practitioner stance from 40 minutes discussion together. So if I'm putting you in the wrong box, sorry about that. But I feel you would be missing it at some point.
You're absolutely right. And so selfishly, I hang on to a couple projects where I'm still hands-on coding, where I still have the opportunity to bring in some new technologies, some new patterns. And I think I will always maintain that. I may not do as much hands-on keyboard coding as I have, but I'll always hold on to a few projects there. And part of the way that I've tried to design my business and ultimately the life around it is to have time to be able to go and explore some of those new areas and really just have fun with it. Right? And I think that's the thing that really keeps a lot of us technologists in the industry is, there's so much new things that we can play with and experience and explore. I certainly want to be able to continue to do that for a long, long time.
Oh yeah, I'm into that. If somebody was wondering, hey, this fractional CTO thing kind of sounds like fun. They've been more or less as a senior software developer somewhere, doing a lot of things inside a company, but saying, hey, this helping other companies put out the right foundations at the right time, that sounds like fun. What would be your advice to start getting into this direction?
Yeah, so it's I like to say that technology is the easiest part of what we do. In many ways it is. And, so as technologists, right, I can Google my way to a solution on the technology side. I think the skill that we have the opportunity to continue to develop is around how do we collaborate with other humans? How do we collaborate and communicate across time zones like you and I are today? So putting yourself in a much more of a leadership position and really focusing on not only the people, the collaboration, but also the business as well, right? I think as technologists, we're always excited about implementing new technologies and new patterns. But at the end of the day, we need to make sure that it serves the business because the business needs to make money in order to pay our, fancy developer salaries. And so I would encourage anyone that's considering something like this to really start to focus on the leadership and the business acumen, because we're solid technologists. We can continue to learn and evolve there, but that's a small portion of what we really need to be focused on to be successful.
Absolutely. And thank you for highlighting this. Brian, it's been a blast listening to your story, starting in GIS and diverging entirely and ending up whispering in the ears of CEOs and CTOs worldwide. That was great. So where would be the best place to continue the discussion with you?
I would say right now I'm most active on LinkedIn. So I encourage everyone to reach out, connect with me, send me a message on there. I'm happy to connect and schedule a call if it makes sense. That's going to be the best place to connect.
Mm-hmm. Do you have anything on your plate that you want to highlight before we call it a day?
I've got a lot of really interesting projects going on right now. You know, a couple in the healthcare space that are AI focused, a couple in education, in finance, cybersecurity. So I'm really, really excited about what this next year holds. I think there's going to be a lot of really fun projects and opportunities. So,
can we read about it on LinkedIn or on your homepage when you write about it?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll definitely be sharing. I mean, I'm learning every day. And so typically what I share on LinkedIn is something I learned the day before. So, yeah.
Well, that's the best source of ideas. It's just falling flat on your face and saying, oh, I have to write about that.
Absolutely right.
Brian, thank you so much. I will add some links to the show notes with LinkedIn, your homepage, and maybe a couple pages of the playbook you've been gathering along. And if you want to connect with Brian, don't hesitate. Go to LinkedIn and reach out. Brian, thank you so much.
Tim, thank you.
And this has been another episode of DevOps Journey. I will see each other next week. Bye-bye. Thanks a lot for tuning in. I hope you have enjoyed this week's episode. If you like the show, please share, rate, and review. It helps more listeners discover those stories. You can find the links to all the platforms the show appears on our website, devjourney.info/subscribe. Talk to you soon.